When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Of radio.
All right, Jason, this is fucking it. This is the one. This is 100. We have now, after this episode is done, we have conquered all 100 movies on this list. I mean, who could possibly start this off for us?
Well, I have a couple of guests, and I'm going to bring in a very special guest to introduce a very special guest. So if you would come in, ladies and gentlemen, His Royal Highness Prince Philip.
Oh, no.
Yes, hello. Yes, hello, Brendan and Jason, was it? Yes, absolutely. Hello. Yes, I'm rather new upstairs, and they told me I should come down here. It's very confusing up there. I don't know if you've heard much about it. It's a sort of Republican place, you see, and it's not necessarily the best place for the royals, but, you know, as soon as I arrived, of course, I found my mother-in-law, and she told me all about your podcast, and, you know, you don't seem to be exceptionally colonialist in your leanings, which is unfortunate, but...
Well, I did hear you had a heck of a snooker game with Henry Kissinger, so that's cool.
I don't believe Henry Kissinger has passed yet.
Not yet.
No, but he's also something of a ghoul, so he's been known to show up on occasion.
I thought he was sick.
No, he's just sick in the head. But that's not why I'm here. I wish to introduce you to my mother-in-law, who wishes to stop by and say a little something-something. Ladies and gentlemen, Her Royal Highness the Queen Mother.
Oh, Jason, she is drunk.
Oh, hello. Yes, hello, ma'am. Just come on in and say hello. Oh, hello. Yes, my favorite podcast in the universe. For Screen and Country, you've come so far, gentlemen. I love your podcast.
Did you just do cocaine, too?
Ma'am, you probably should not do that. It's not appropriate. I'll do what I want. And... woo! Seriously. No, seriously, stick with me, okay? Seriously.
Yep.
I was here for the first episode, and now I'm here for the last episode. Are you happy?
Well, the last movie on the list.
Are you happy?
We're not done.
Are you happy?
Jason, tell her we're happy.
We're happy, ma'am. We're very happy.
Good. That's why I live. I live to please. Woo!
Ma'am, I suspect we should probably go back to... the heaven and tried to set up in a corner where no one will notice us.
I will do no such thing. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you with all the bearing of all the royal support in the world and beyond in Republican heaven and elsewhere, the final episode of the British Film Institute's Top 100 list here on the greatest podcast in the universe as far as I'm concerned, for Screen and...
Country.
Thank you very much, Brendan. Jetpack!
Why does she have to have her jetpack carried by, like, six dudes? Like, it's just a jetpack.
You have to understand. That's a privilege that comes with the rank. I haven't left yet.
Wait, why are you still here?
You know, I don't really like it up there. It's very Republican, you see, and as a royal, one finds that one doesn't have much pull in a republic.
Okay, if you stay here, you have to talk about The Third Man for 90 minutes.
I don't care for that film. Goodbye, jetpack.
Wow, that was special, though.
It was special, but I need people to stop saying it's the final episode.
It's not the final episode, guys. It is the final episode of this particular run, of this run of 100 movies that we started. The purpose we started this podcast for, we have accomplished. It does not mean that we are finished.
No. And we are not, in fact, wrapped up. Like, this will wrap up at the end of the year.
Yes.
We'll have a couple more Brit picks.
Sure.
And we'll have a wrap up, and then we'll have a big old wrap up episode to tie the whole thing with a bow. And then we will do other things.
Well, but then we're coming home.
We're coming home. We're doing Canadian films, the top 10 Canadian films, according to, well, we'll find out. I don't remember at this moment, but it's a big thing.
I may also have to make you watch Just Because, Men with Brooms.
Well, maybe. We'll see.
And we can watch a 15-minute cut of Passchendaele of all the cool scenes.
I don't think that's happening. but yeah, we're going to briefly talk about that, and then we'll go back to British films in another way.
Talk about the TV movie The Arrow with Dan Aykroyd.
I don't think we need to do that.
I think we do.
But this podcast, now that you've heard our entire itinerary,
yeah.
This podcast is a podcast about British film, of course, the top 100 British films of all time. We are talking about the final one on this list. This podcast is called For Screen
and Country.
And I am Brendan.
And I remain Jason.
And I continue to be Brendan.
And I'm still Jason even now. I said it before, it was true. I say it now, continues to be true.
It's a constant truth.
It is a truth that is immutable, at least until I decide to legally change my name, but I have no plans to do that.
Only when the BFI list ends. Oh, no! You have to hurry up!
And then we'll be Beanie and Jackass in the mornings.
But weirdly enough, I'll be Jackass and you'll be Beanie.
Yeah, obviously. I've got a Beanie coming in the mail. I bought it on Wish. It should be here in 9 weeks.
Oh, no. Cancel that order.
Ooh, free seeds.
So that is what we do, Jason. That is who we are. We are talking about the last movie up for discussion. Number one. According to the BFI Top 100, the best British film of all time, The Third Man. Is it? We'll find out. But before we do, we need to read some comments regarding last week's film. And that was, of course,
Nil by Mouth.
Jason Las Vegas. Jason Las Vegas.
I'm not now, nor have I ever been to Las Vegas.
Jason, I just made you a new movie.
Where I go to Las Vegas?
Is you going to Las Vegas, you play Las Vegas. You play the founder of Las Vegas. The premise keeps changing. Stay with me. Jason Las Vegas. You're like, my last name's pretty cool. It's kind of classy and kind of trashy.
Sure.
I think maybe I should found an entire city
and
name it after me, Jason Las Vegas. And then somebody comes up and says, how about just Las Vegas? And you have him killed for his what's the word, where you don't take someone's orders, your manager.
Insubordination.
Insubordination. Yeah. You kill him for his insubordination. Sure. But then you say, hey, what about just Las Vegas? And people say, that's a great idea, Jason, because they don't want to get killed.
Makes sense.
And then, lo and behold, you invent Las Vegas, and there's a dinosaur fight, the end.
I like where you're going, because with that character, I mean, if your name's Las Vegas, you do one of two things. You found an entire fucking city, or you become a professional wrestler.
Right.
And I don't know that I'd look like a professional wrestler, so I'd have to found that city.
Well, it depends what decade, Jason.
That's true. I could maybe in the 50s for sure. I theoretically could be like a worker or like a what do you call him, a jobber for Gorgeous George.
I think we could scrap with Lou Thesz. Mm.
I just put on a pair of tights and some boots, and I'm good to go.
Exactly. You don't have to have a personality, and you do, so you're at an advantage.
Hey.
Jason, we need to read some comments about Nil by Mouth, a truly uplifting film.
Yeah, yes.
We'll start off quick because there's quite a few, actually.
Sure.
A few people have seen this. Davis Donovan says, it's aggressively pretty good.
Put that on the box.
Very 90s in that indie movie about seedy lowlife's way. Kathy Burke is great in it. Wish she had more roles like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Aggressively pretty good is a pretty good way.
It's a fine line.
It's a pretty good way to say, you know what, this isn't like the greatest thing, but this is probably a good version of this okay thing.
It's like they tried with this and they ended up with something solid.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, pretty.
Hey, I said it's pretty good. That's aggressively pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. Our next comment, Brendan, is Patrick C. Taylor, who says, I felt like it was well made without being at all memorable.
Oh.
Yeah, and I agree to that. There's not a, like... The most memorable thing for that movie, really, in my mind, is Kathy Burke, and then, of course, Ray Winstone, but beyond that.
I mean, it's up there with that movie and My Name is Joe has one of the best, this guy is drunk off his fucking rocker scenes, though.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Actually, it has a lot of comparisons to My Name is Joe, sort of.
Well, did Joe beat up anybody? Like a lady?
No, he did in his past, though,
remember? In his past, yes, and he was moving past it, but then he got hammered.
Maybe that's Ray Winstone after In My Name is Joe.
Oh, maybe.
Jason, our old pal Adam Pellman says, it's a difficult viewing experience given the subject matter, but I remember thinking it was excellent.
Most excellent.
Most excellent. Wow. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but with the characters from Know by Mouth.
Hmm.
So it'd be
Kathy Burke and Ray Winstone going through time together. And oh, no.
Who totally just Melvin Death.
Look, honey, we've met Napoleon. Yes, I believe you are right in hitting your wife. That's what we do, huh?
I knew all the historical figures would agree with me.
I knew I was right. I fucking knew I was right.
Oh, slap. Man. What do we got next?
Jacob Skinner writes in, and I believe he's related to the wrestler Skinner.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying the fictional character.
And Jacob, Skinner. If I made that joke before, my apologies. It was probably a long time ago.
Jacob Skinner.
Jacob writes, not so fun fact, until Darkest Hour, this movie represented the only major awards, two BAFTAs, Gary Oldman had won. And of course, they weren't for acting. It was a smidge annoying last year to hear that people were bored by Oldman's recent award success because he hadn't had any Oscar gold or otherwise. I assume.
And just a little peek behind the curtain, because Jason made it very obvious. I might not have copied the full comment, yeah. So we might have guessed at the end, but I'm pretty sure that's what you said.
I had to improvise on a C more.
Yeah. Okay.
But thank you for your comment, Jacob.
Yes. Thank you, Jacob. Matthew Ball says, the title of this movie is throwing me off as a medical professional. It's usually fully Latin, nil per os, or fully English, nothing by mouth.
Oh, so Gary Oldman just doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about.
He's just combining shit.
Yeah. Well, also, Ray Winstone's character is not exactly the sharpest knife in the drawer, so maybe he just didn't understand.
And you know how I feel about mixing things, Jason. All things. I don't like mixing. Except for mixing races. That's fun.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, was miscegenation a word in your vocabulary? It's barely one of mine.
Who's
since that? I can't even pronounce it.
She sounds lovely.
Don't ask.
Don't tell.
Brendan, our exact next comment is from Greg Breen, who writes in, excellent film, a real masterpiece with an amazing performance by the great Kathy Burke. I agree. Gloved Kathy Burke. Can't say it enough.
You say you gloved her?
I gloved her. Oh, no.
I don't
know what that...
Okay, no.
Oh, no. Oh,
there's
that's...
so many things that
oh,
could be, and I don't want it to be
no,
any of
and
them.
No, I'm not thinking of a terrible... I'm thinking of an awful.
You'll tell me off air?
Yeah.
Okay. BS, who tells the truth here, says, it is brutal, but brilliant. If you want a depressing but expertly crafted as fuck afternoon, pair this with Tim Roth's The War Zone.
Not familiar.
Not familiar either, but Tim Roth, he sure
another
looks
great
sad.
Actor who decided to make a movie, and it made a depressing movie.
He looks like a sad man.
Why are actors so depressed? Sad. Actors, guys, cheer up. Come on. You play pretend for a living. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and we all know that every actor makes $10 million a movie, 100%. No matter what the role.
I get it. Or go work in a restaurant or something, you know.
But that's true, right?
Yeah.
Like Patton Oswalt made like $10 million for Blade Trinity, I'm guessing.
He made $10 million for Blade Trinity, he made $10 million for Big Fan, and he made $40 million for The Comedians of Comedy, but he had to split it with the other three people.
Oh, boo.
I know.
All right, Jason, take us home with our last comment. Don't make the joke.
No jokes. Andrew Littlefield, thank you for writing. We always like hearing from you. Good but hard to watch and purposely ugly. It was well received. He should make more.
Yeah, only movie Gary Oldman's ever directed.
I'm sure Gary Oldman these days would make a movie about Eric Clapton heroically resisting a vaccine mandate or something.
And you know what it would be called? Wonderful Tonight.
Probably. But thank you all to all who commented on this episode.
Thank you all.
We love hearing from you.
We do.
I guess this is the Third Man episode. So,
well, before we get to the Third Man,
well,
though,
no,
Jason,
but I'm saying this is the last episode. We'll have comments for Third Man in a future episode. But mm-hmm. Wow, it's crazy, huh?
Crazy, crazy, crazy.
Man, time flies.
It sure does. But you know what doesn't fly? Numbers on the BFI Top 100. Jason,
yeah.
I need to find out what number 97 is on the AFI Top 100. This is one of the last times we do this. This is down to the wire. It's a big fight to the finish here. I need to know what Know by Mouth is up against on the American side of things. Hit me.
What number was it?
97.
That is 2010's grown-ups.
Shut the fuck up. Grow up.
And what movie did we watch?
We watched Know by Mouth.
Know by Mouth.
The
one
we just spent 10 minutes talking about.
Well, this is an interesting companion movie. Stop doing that. This is 97 is, of course, the obscure and much ignored 1982 Ridley Scott joint, Blade Runner.
Okay. Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. Blade Runner certainly has its own kind of depressing atmosphere, but there's less women beating, isn't there? He doesn't hit Sean Young, does he?
Doesn't he, like, force himself on her, though, a little
bit? Yeah, but that's fine, right?
Yeah, because she's a robot.
She's a robot. It doesn't matter. And he's a robot, too, I think, maybe.
Maybe. That's all we got sex bots for, am I right? Yeah, stick your dick in them. They don't care.
And here come the sex robots. Shout out to my wonks.
Weep, wop, wop,
wop.
I don't know if I was talking robot or chocobo.
I don't think chocobos talk. I think they just make bird noises.
I think they say wheat wah wah.
I don't think they do.
You know what they do?
What do they do?
They talk about this week's movie, Jason.
Yes.
I don't know if they do, but I'm killing it with these segues.
Chocobos love the third
so
man.
So I'm not going to stop doing these segues ever. Never. Riding segues, doing segues, living that segue life.
That's right.
But it's time to talk about this week's movie. This is the last movie on the list. Jason, this is the big day. We're talking about the number one, the best British film of all British time.
The Third Man.
Yes, that's right, and I'm allowed to say it one more time, goddammit. That music can only mean one thing. We are talking about number one on the BFI Top 100 list. The this list's equivalent to the AFI Top 100 Citizen Kane.
Number one, Brendan, is the cream of the crop. I rise to the top. I never eat a pig because a pig is a cop. Brendan, this is the top of the top.
This is
what these old people think is the greatest British movie ever made.
No, I don't need you getting your soapbox here, your ACAB bullshit on this show, even though it's true.
The cop in this movie is certainly a bit of a bastard.
Yeah. We'll get into it. But this movie, yes, The Third Man. Jason, this is directed by a man who we've talked about before because it is directed by Carol Reed, who directed Oliver!
The musical.
The musical version, yes.
Number one, Brendan, this is not a musical.
Spoiler alert, I like this a lot more than Oliver.
Yes.
I didn't dislike, but you know what I mean.
This is not a musical, but we can say right off the bat, the soundtrack in this movie is a zither.
But it's great.
Oh, it's great. It's fantastic. It's a weird choice, but it works.
It's such an interesting choice because The Third Man is a film noir.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, I don't think there's any way to argue that it isn't.
It just doesn't
have that like femme fatale, I guess. Not really.
No,
but
she's pretty secondary. Female character.
Yeah, she's not a villain.
No.
I don't think. But
she's Austrian, so she's kind of a villain.
She's kind of a villain
for being Austrian. Sorry to all of our listeners in Austria.
You're all villains.
Do we have any listeners in Austria?
I think so.
Oh, nice. Hi, Austria. We love you.
Hello, Austria.
Yeah, they understood. That's how they talk there.
You got to say it in their language,
Jason.
Yeah,
that's right.
But yes, Carol Reed directing this one.
Sure.
This is a movie released in 1949?
Yes, sir.
I believe, yes. 1949. 4 years after the end of the war, so probably filming it 3 years after the end of the war.
And we see a lot of that because there's a lot of rubble.
There's a lot of rubble. It takes place in Vienna, which is very much war-torn.
I have to look this up. I thought to look this up. I forgot to. I don't know what Vienna went through as far as at the end of the war. We all know about Berlin and what Berlin went through.
Yeah, and I mean, they were in Austria, so I don't imagine it was anything good.
No. I mean, that's where Hitler was from.
And we certainly see, you know, lots of, like you said, lots of rubble, lots of bombed out buildings. Mm-hmm. As the movie goes on, it's kind of in the background just to kind of remind you of like what is going on at mm-hmm. the time. Everything's just kind of crumbling.
Well, and it's actually got a similar setup to Berlin, where there's the different zones that are occupied by the different major powers.
Yeah,
and it, them working in a kind of an international way to deal with the city.
Yeah, we get a lot of power struggles or like people yep. wanting to stay out of each other's way because, yep. you know, I'm an Austrian, I'm an American, I'm a Brit, I'm, you know, whatever.
Wherever you are, you don't want to end up in the Soviet zone.
Wherever you are, I'll be with you. You didn't think there was going to be singing, right?
Well, it's a good thing you're a terrible singer because we're not going to get DRM'd
because
of that.
Excuse me?
Yeah, I'm saying it.
That picked up on the radars immediately. People knew what the fuck that was.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
The algorithm knows it?
Yep.
Okay. Well, then we're fucked.
Jason, this movie stars Joseph Cotten.
Of Citizen Kane.
Of Citizen Kane, who we have not, I mean, is not in any other movie.
No.
Of which is not surprising, because he is an American actor.
Yeah. The greatest British movie of all time features an American actor and is set in Vienna.
I think that's hilarious, by the way. We also have Alida Valli as Anna Schmidt. She's
credited
our,
just as Valli.
Yeah, kind of like Cher.
Nice.
We have, returning to the podcast, Jason, I was very excited. Major Calloway is played by Trevor Howard. He was the lead in Brief Encounter.
Oh, that's why his head looked familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, that shape. I recognize that shape.
He was the dude.
Nice. Did he have a scar on his face like in that movie too?
I don't know because I think he had a lot of facial hair. Yeah.
Wait, you're saying he plays the doctor that is like is courting her? Or that is having the affair with her? Or are you saying
he's
the
main guy having the affair?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, yes.
But what I love about him being in this movie is that, spoiler alert, there's a scene later where they're in like that cafe by the train, and that looked like the same cafe as Brief Encounter. So I was
didn't even think about that.
Wait a second. Was Crazy. He like, fellas, I know a good location where you could shoot this.
Was this guy in any other movies besides these two movies on the list?
No.
I mean, goddamn, if you're going to be in two movies, one and two is a pretty good position to be in.
Yeah, that's true. Is Brief Encounters two or three, I think?
It's number two.
Number two. Yeah. Wow. Okay. We have Paul Horbiger as the porter.
Yes, the German guy that speaks varying levels of English depending on when you talk to him.
Ernst Deutsch as Baron Kurtz.
He's got a real like British Peter Lorre kind of look to him.
Eric Ponto as Dr. Winkel. Which is a hilarious little spelling gag.
Yeah, well, when it's German,
when,
right?
When he's supposed to be Dr. Winkel, you know, everybody pronounces it Dr. Winkel, so of course Joseph Cotten assumes that's, you know, it's Dr. Winkel, and he says, no, it's actually Winkel.
Winkel.
Yeah. It seems like it's like a gag right out of a Mel Brooks movie. we also have Siegfried Brewer as Popescu. And Bernard Lee as Sergeant Payne.
Wait.
Bernard Lee of Q fame.
Holy, wait, no. We used M.
Well, that's what I mean.
It was Desmond Llewellyn who was Q.
Eminon he was part of. And last but not least, Jason.
So wait, you're saying Bernard Lee plays that sergeant. Wow, that's crazy. No idea. That's amazing.
Sergeant Payne, yeah.
Wonderful.
And then last but not least, Jason, Orson Welles as Harry Lime, inspiring the very drink we are having right now.
Well, not quite, because there is a drink called a Harry Lime, Brendan, and I looked it up, and it was just lime juice and vodka, and I don't want to fucking drink vodka. So instead, we got some...
I said inspiring.
Yeah, so we got some Sol beers, because I couldn't find a six-pack of Corona, and we just put limes in them, so...
They're pretty good.
They are good, yeah.
Especially with the lime, and nice tinge to it.
Yeah, no, limes are great. Gin and tonic and lime, that's fantastic. I want to try a scotch and soda, but use like bubbly lime in it. I bet you that'd be real good.
I want to do the top 100 concert movies of all time. And then for our drink, instead of drinking something, we just eat pop rocks the whole time. Because it's like pop and rock. It's like two music genres in one.
I see your joke.
Yeah. You see my joke and you look at it in the face and you walk away.
See, I thought you were going to say we were going to watch concert films, but then we would just like do heroin or something.
Well... Oh, well, I mean, when we watch the Justin Bieber,
we're going to watch the top 100 Grateful Dead bootlegs.
I'm sure there's a top 100 concert films out there somewhere.
There's got to be. I mean, there's
like, what
got to be
say?
At least 100.
So this song was good. This song was pretty good. I like this song. Didn't care for this one.
I like this specific performance of Take It Easy.
Yeah. Did you notice that? And then our reoccurring segment will be, how high do you think they were?
Yes, absolutely. Could we get a list of the top 100 worst concert films of all time?
Oh, well, that means we're going to watch a bunch of like One Direction and strung out Fleetwood Mac in the 80s or something.
We're going to watch Spice World a number of times. My wife's going to kill me for saying that.
How dare you, sir?
I know.
So the third man. It's number
now,
one.
What about the first and second men? I didn't see those movies. Do we need to catch up our audience on
those?
Oh,
Lord. Okay, well, sound out the plot of the first and second man.
So in the first man, that was Neil Armstrong landing on the moon, which happens 20 years after this movie.
Right.
The second man.
With Ryan Gosling, yeah.
The second man, that was the first 10 minutes of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Okay.
And then the third man is a movie about... the spy stuff, not even spy stuff, racketeering.
Did you watch this?
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's all spies, right? Yeah, and then Michael Caine's in there, and there's a computer.
There's the Best Man with Ty Diggs. Best Man Christmas with, I think, just Ty Diggs.
What's
again.
Your favorite Ty Diggs movie?
Oh, man. So many to choose from. I don't want to say a different movie, and then someone's like, "Oh, that's Eddie Griffin, you racist prick."
That's Tyrese.
Yeah, Fast Nine. What were you gonna say?
I don't even know. I don't know why I'm acting like this. This is a great movie.
We're just bullshitting, Jason.
We're just bullshitting,
Jason. Tell us
what is this movie about?
What is this movie about? This movie in all the basic terms.
So we've got what is his name? Holly Watkins.
Holly Martins. Played by Joseph Cotten.
Which is, yes, Holly is a dumb name for a man. I'm sorry, Hollies, if you're out there.
Wow, name shame.
You could go by Hollis.
You know, you sound like Jimmy Kimmel at that one Oscars thing where somebody told him his name and he was like, and then someone said, my name is John. And he's like, that's a good name. And that was like.
Well, it is a good name. It's solid. Unless you're king. You don't want to be King John II.
You're getting into the boomer humor. Okay, sorry. Continue. Holly Martins.
So Holly Martins is a writer of pulpy Western fiction.
Yeah, like a bad writer, right?
No, I don't know that he's bad.
He writes trash.
He writes like dime store novels.
Yeah, well, trash. I'm not saying is bad.
No, I don't even think it's necessarily trash. It's like kind of generic Western adventure fiction. Like,
Jason, half of my podcast career is trash.
That's fine.
I mean, have nothing against trash.
I don't think of it as trash in the sense of it like being like sexual or explicit.
Oh, no,
in that
way. I mean
it's
like just poorly written.
Yeah, well,
I'll bring it up later.
Hey,
I'll wait.
The Sarge likes the book, so we only have one guy that's talking about it, and he likes it.
But there's something else. We'll get to it when we get to
it. So anyways, he's a writer of some repute. He gets invited to Vienna by his old pal, Harry Lime, and Harry's got a job for him. He hasn't seen Harry in years, but they were like, they like grew up together, you know, they're tight. So he goes over to Vienna and shows up, and sure enough, he gets there, and Harry's fucking dead. They're having his funeral.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to point out right now, we don't see Orson Welles for like almost 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Like maybe 75 to 80 minutes, of which I'm watching this movie and I'm like, man, this could have really benefited from a 1995 Seven-esque campaign by not advertising that Orson Welles
was
in it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. That if he said, yeah, because how would that have blown people's minds if they're fucking watching this movie and all of a sudden Orson Welles shows up? Now, I get back then they would want to sell this movie based on Orson Welles being in it.
I wonder if they advertise it.
Was Kevin Spacey at that time as much of a box office like known in 1997 or whenever they made
95?
That movie? 95? Was that? Because that was even before... Usual Suspects, wasn't it?
Was it?
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, I guess it was the same year.
So it's not like he was super known at that time.
No, but he had done enough stuff, I think.
I guess it was a surprise. And it's certainly a surprise watching it now, and it's even more of a surprise watching it in 2021. I'll tell you that.
I wonder if we do overestimate the surprise of that, though, being in that it's in 1995, because I think people would have said, oh, I know who that actor is, but I don't think it would have had the reaction if that happened in, like, 2004.
But I think they did intentionally not put his name in the credits.
Oh, they didn't, for sure.
For that reason, but also, yeah, like between 1995, or between, like, whenever he became big with, like, I don't know, K-Pax or something, and now.
Yeah,
that was the one that launched his career.
Launched his career.
But between that point and then the point where he turned out he was a creep, like, in that era, like, watching Seven, it's just like, fucking shit, it's Kevin Spacey!
Correction, he became a creep. He was never a creep before that day.
No, that day, he just suddenly spontaneously generated into a creep.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about Seven. We're talking about fucking... Harry Lime, who doesn't show up until all the way into this movie. And you're right. It would have been better if they hadn't told anybody, but they wanted to sell this movie based on Orson Welles.
It's also a movie that was released in 1949. You can't expect to go into this and not know that Orson Welles.
I mean, he was a huge star.
Yeah.
Massive. Been a big star for like 20 years.
And not physically yet. Still svelte.
Oh, man. This is Orson Welles in his prime. This is not like Orson Welles in A Man for All Seasons. He gets just a smidge more screen time in this movie. But he's like prime Orson Welles. He's young. He's virile. He's smooth shaven. He's not. If he is drunk, it doesn't look like he's drunk.
No, he seems very, very, like, you know, calm, cool, collected. And he's
so fucking good. He's so magnetic when he's on screen. I can't help myself when it comes to Orson Welles. I'm such a fucking, like, little girl about it.
You just got to take it out and start fapping.
I mean, it's hard not to. Already hard.
Wow. So, yeah, he does get invited. And then Harry Lyme, it turns out, is dead, quote unquote. We find out, obviously, that's not the case later on. And so he's kind of doing his own little investigation into
like a lot of other movies we've seen of people that, you know, that aren't like officially police or anything, but they decide they want to get involved and figure out what's going on. Kind of like the Michael Caine one, Get Carter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much so. Although I would argue that Holly is a much more positive character.
He certainly beats up a lot less people in the process.
A lot less women, too.
Yeah.
Actually, I would say he gets beat up more than anything else.
He does. He gets popped in the mouth, but was it the Sarge that pops him in the mouth, or was it actually Calloway?
No, when he's talking about the Sarge, when he's talking to the police officer, the guy, his buddy, the Sarge, comes in and punches him, thinking that he's going to punch the police officer.
But then he's like, oh, wait, you're the author. Hey, I love your books.
Yeah. So, yeah, he comes into town. There's a funeral. He finds that Harry Lyme is dead. He's investigating. Eventually, he finds out that Harry Lyme is very much not dead and that he was involved in some really, really bad racket, selling shitty penicillin to hospitals, to children's hospitals, where kids are literally thinking they're taking penicillin and then years later either going insane or dying.
Which I don't know if that's a thing that happens from diluted penicillin.
Well, no, I don't think it's happening from the diluted penicillin. I think it's happening because the penicillin was not strong enough to actually cure what they had, like meningitis.
That's true. That can neurologically affect you for sure.
Yeah, so they give it to them, and they're like, "Oh, your meningitis is cured. Be off."
Mm. Yeah, it's a real scumbag position. And that's the thing is that when we finally kind of meet Harry, when we see him for the first time, we have a conversation with him. Of course, it's Orson Welles, right? He's super charismatic. He's super like just magnetic.
Yeah,
and it's hard, and you understand why Martin's is friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
Why they get along.
Childhood friends,
yeah, they go way back.
And it's crazy to see them on screen together, by the way, knowing, you know, having seen Citizen Kane,
where they, you know, made one of the greatest movies of all time.
Yeah.
Is it number one? That's a different podcast.
Citizen Kane is number one on the AFI.
Now, the Unspooled people, did that end up being any of their number ones?
I think it was their number one. I think it just stayed there.
That's understandable. Yeah. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
I'm an American. I've always been an American.
I know this is late in the movie, but you brought up Orson Welles, and we got to talk about Orson Welles, obviously. Let's hear his justification, maybe, because he talks about the racket, and he talks about, you know, what he does to Holly, and let's just hear some of that.
Old man, you never should have gone to the police, you know. You ought to leave this thing alone.
Have you ever seen any of your victims?
You know, I never feel comfortable on these sort of things. Victims? Don't be melodramatic. Look down there. Would you really feel any pity if one of those dots stopped moving forever? If I offered you £20,000 for every dot that stopped, would you really, old man, tell me to keep my money? Or would you calculate how many dots you could afford to spend? Free of income tax, only. Free of income tax? The only way you can save money nowadays.
A lot of good your money will do you in jail.
That jail's in another zone. There's no proof against me. Besides you.
I should be pretty easy to get rid of.
Pretty easy?
Wouldn't be too sure.
I carry a gun. I don't think they'd look for a bullet wound after you hit that ground.
Dug up your coffin.
And found Harbin? Pity.
Goddamn.
He's so good. But Jason, you wanted to clarify something for this scene.
So we mentioned that he faked his death. So basically it boiled down to the story was that he had gotten run over by a car when he went to see the Baron.
Yeah.
Who's a German guy or Austrian guy.
Austrian. How dare you?
They're in Vienna. It's Austria. They're not the same thing. Just because they speak the same language, British and Americans are not the same. But yeah, so the story was that he got run over by a car and that 3 men had carried him off. Or at least that was what the custodian at the building said, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course,
the porter.
The porter, right? And so he finds out that one of them was the Baron, Kurtz. Another one was this Romanian guy, Ciescu or something.
Pulescu.
Pulescu.
Yeah. And then they say there's a third man. Oh, and then the doctor ran over afterwards. And then, but then before that, the porter claims there was a third man.
Claims there was a third man there. But the Romanian guy and the Baron both claim there was only two.
Right.
It was just the two of them that did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that throws it into the mix. And then, of course, later on we learn because it was fake death, it must have been the young guy, the dude that ended up in the grave that got run over, and fucking Lime was the third man dragging him along.
Yeah.
Hence the title.
The third man. God save the queen.
All right. Bye-bye. No, we can't end yet. I've got another beer to drink.
So I think we mentioned it briefly, but I want to talk about the zither a little bit more.
Sure.
Because the zither's great.
And
this is so unusual for a film noir, especially. Because you think, like, you know, these movies have, like, they're very dark. They have, like,
you think,
brooding
like
music.
Stand-up bass or some jazz or something like that. Like, kind of the era music.
You don't expect to hear, like, and I think we've covered a lot of movies where sometimes they try it and it's great.
Yeah.
And sometimes they try it and we're just like, that does not work.
It just does not, it doesn't feel, it feels disjointed with what you're trying to achieve.
I think of the scene in My Left Foot, which I otherwise love, that scene where he's looking at his foot and it's playing that really dramatic, like, dun, dun, and it's like, okay.
Yeah. The zither in this movie is interesting because at the beginning, like, the sound of it is very like, like 1950s, like Hawaiian movie kind of vibe to it.
Well, I saw a couple of negative comments. Most people were saying, you know, how great it was, but a couple of negative comments said that it reminded them of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah, no, absolutely, because it's got that vibe to it. But, and you hear that in the credits, but then you watch the movie and it's completely appropriate for everything that happens. Like, it doesn't, you watch the movie, the sound, at least to me, the soundtrack does not stick out as inappropriate. It sticks out as perfectly suited for what they're doing. Which is amazing because it shouldn't, really.
Yeah, 100%. And it creates tension. Like, there's scenes where it's a very dramatic scene, and instead of getting that, like, we get, and it just makes you uneasy because you're like, wait a second, this isn't what we're supposed to be hearing right now. Mm. Like, it creates a sort of there's a sort of unease.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
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 Interesting to note, it also has a post-war thriller, a post-war film noir, whatever, post-war film, because again, a lot of stuff about these, like, four different cultures, at kind of a crossroads, and people don't, like I said, people don't want to mess with each other, people don't want to step on each other's foot, you know, it's a very tense time in Vienna, obviously.
Was this a make-work project for ex-Nazi Austrian production crews?
Come again?
I mean, like you know, you're employing a bunch of, because they, if this was actually filmed in Vienna, I don't know that it was. I mean, it looks like it was, but who am I to say? Did you ever look that up? Do you know? I mean, there's Austrian actors in this movie. They probably have an Austrian crew. Like, is it a make-work project for these poor destitute Austrians in the post-war Europe? Maybe. Either way, it works because the movie is quite good.
Maybe I should now explain my point earlier where I said I think Holly Martins in this movie, Joseph Cotten playing him, is a bad writer. This is my hypothesis.
Okay.
All right.
I'm not claiming he's like Shakespeare or anything.
No, but I think he's an actively bad writer.
Okay.
And so, like you said, he writes these pulpy westerns that the Sarge certainly likes. That's the, you know, the cop, like Trevor Howard's kind of assistant who's always with him. But he gets invited to, because the Sarge really likes him and he recommends him to some like lecture dude, like a guy who stages lectures or stages events, because he says, oh yes, last week we had Shakespeare and the week before that we had Indian belly dancers or something.
Striptease.
yeah, but he asks him to to go and do like a literature lecture. And we kind of forget about it for a while. And then later in the movie, he gets kind of like thrown in a car. It's like, your car's here. And he's like, oh, great. I've got a car.
This is a wonderfully modern fake out. Like, this is a great scene where you think he's getting like shuttled away and as part of this conspiracy because the guy's driving like a maniac. But then he shows up just to this fucking lecture hall to drop him off for this lecture that he agreed to do earlier in the movie.
And he drove like a maniac because he was going to be late.
Yeah.
It also kind of reminds me a little bit of that scene in the 39 Steps where he pretends to be that politician. Not that he pretends to be anything, but it's just got the same vibe I found. But, okay, so he gets there, and yes, he's unprepared because he forgot about it, but I think he's not a good writer. Let's listen to him field some questions here.
Yeah, well, I suppose that is what I meant to say.
Of course, of course, of course.
Do you believe, Mr. Martins, in the stream of consciousness?
Stream of consciousness. Well,
what author has chiefly influenced you?
Gray.
Gray? What Gray?
Zane Gray.
Oh, that's Mr. Martin's little joke, of course, sir. We all know perfectly well Zane Gray wrote what we call westerns, cowboys and bandits.
Mr. James Joyce, now, where would you put him?
Oh, would you mind repeating that question?
I said, where would you put Mr. James Joyce? In what category?
Can I ask? Is Mr. Martins engaged on a new book?
Yes. It's called The Third Man.
A novel, Mr. Martins?
It's a murder story. I've just started it. It's based on fact.
Why, it's Mr. Popesco. Oh, very great pleasure to see you here, Mr. Popesco. As you know, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Popesco is a very great supporter of one of our medical charities.
Are you a slow writer, Mr. Martin?
Not when I get interested.
I'd see you were doing something pretty dangerous this time.
Yeah?
Mixing fact and fiction.
Should I make it all fact?
Why no, Mr. Martins. I'd say stick to fiction. Straight fiction.
I'm too far along with the book, Mr. Popesco.
Haven't you ever scrapped a book, Mr. Martins?
Never.
Pity.
So the second half of that scene is great because that's when Popesco comes in and starts messing with him.
Yes. No, that is one of those wonderful scenes.
Double entendre kind of thing.
Two people talking about something but having a completely different conversation than what they're actually saying to each other.
Right. So I love that. But I swear to God, that first part of the scene shows that he is an incompetent writer.
I disagree, Brendan. I disagree 100%. What that shows to me is that he is maybe not a well-read author or well-read writer. Like, they're talking about, you know, they ask him about James Joyce. Now,
asked him what stream of consciousness meant.
Yeah, and maybe in 1949, that was something that you would have to be like in the academic circles of Europe to kind of understand as a thing.
Come on.
But they also they ask him about James Joyce. Now, Brendan, have you read James Joyce?
Jason, I've read all of the James Joyce all of the time.
What's your favorite James Joyce book?
I'd have to say Running Man.
That's a great book, but that's a Richard Bachman novel.
I think you mean Stephen King.
I think you mean to shut up. I have not read James
Joyce. But I am not a writer, Jason.
Do you know how many people I know who have read James Joyce? One.
And is he a writer?
He is a writer.
There you go!
But that's not the point. I didn't think about that through. But look, he's obviously not he's not an academic. This guy is a working man's writer. He asks him who his influences are, and he says Zane Grey, and he's like, oh, he makes a little joke. But no, that's exactly who influences him, and probably Louis L'Amour and like other Western writers. He's probably seen Stagecoach a million times in the, you know, at the theater. Like, you know, this is 1949. Like, Westerns are big business in the United States and will continue to be so for a number of years. Gunsmoke, which hasn't even started yet, Brendan, on TV, will run through the fucking 70s.
Do you think he would have been a big Paint Your Wagon fan?
Gonna paint the wagon, gonna paint it fine. Gonna use oil-based paint because the wood is pine. Have you actually seen Paint Your Wagon?
No.
Me neither.
I don't intend to anytime soon.
Well, we should do it for a podcast.
Oh.
It would be perfect for What Were They Thinking? Because you're going to ask, what were they thinking?
Probably. But I feel like it's a 2.5-hour musical, and I don't want Nathan to die on the show.
Oh, man. I would love to torture Nathan that way. Nathan, if you're listening, and you're not. But if you're listening, I want to torture you.
Nathan, if you're listening, you're not. I want you to be my bride.
Oh.
You heard it here first, folks.
You already got that nice anniversary message from The Godfather, so.
Hey. You know what? I'll take it.
Yeah.
So again, also going back to this whole thing being a film noir, the cinematography is really interesting. And it's also, so you watch it and for a second you're like, oh, you know, I've seen this before, but this is 1949.
Seen this before because you have watched Battlefield Earth.
Well, let's talk about how much better the Dutch angles are in this movie.
They're not quite as Dutch,
but they serve a fucking purpose.
Yes, they do.
In Battlefield Earth, they're just like, meh, Dutch angle.
Why not? Oh, it's like, man, a comic book. Why not?
But there's really interesting uses of that Dutch angle. Like, aside from that, also, we have like that cool lighting effect where it's the blinds, and you just see like her eyes lit
the
up.
Classic film noir technique with the black and white photography.
Which wouldn't have been old hat at the time, I don't think. And you get that whole, there were film noirs in the 30s,
say, like,
obviously.
Like,
but
39 Steps certainly had a lot of that.
Sure. But the Dutch angles in this movie are utilized really interestingly. Like, there's a scene where, okay, so Holly Martins has kind of teamed up with Anna, who is like Harry Lime's like lover.
Yes.
And she's like a singer and a dancer and everything, and she's kind of helping him along. And there's a scene where he goes to the porter to get information. And the porter at this point has gotten a little sheepish. He's like, you know, I think I should probably stop giving you information because I'm going to get myself in trouble. There's powerful people in this city. They're going to get me. And it goes to a Dutch angle. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I thought someone was going to get hurt or something. But really all that happens is a child enters the room and sees this whole thing go down. And not a lot of focus is put on him, but we get enough to see him. And then later in the movie, the porter is killed. And the child is there, and the last thing he saw was Holly in the room arguing with the porter. And I thought it was really interesting that they set that up with a Dutch angle earlier on to get you to remember that. Because then it kind of ties in. You're like, oh, right, that's why that kid was there. Everything in this movie, like the screenplay in this movie, is flawless. Like, it's just everything ties together so nicely.
Yeah, I noticed that, especially with the way the movie opens and the way the movie ends. There's a symmetry to it where the movie opens up with Harry Lime's funeral, and then the movie closes with Harry Lime's second and real funeral.
I wonder if that ties into Graham Greene, the writer of this movie, because you told me before we started recording, he also did Brighton Rock.
Yes, that was the one that on the list that we also had watched.
And that was one that felt like, to me, like a perfect screenplay, that everything tied together so nicely. There were callbacks to things. There were little things that became important later. And I think that just speaks to how good of a writer he is.
Also, about a similar gangster character, although I would say that Richard Attenborough's character in that movie was a little more crazy than Harry Lime is.
He's definitely more of an id than Harry Lime is.
Yeah.
And I want to play. Actually, want to play the scene where the kid kind of alerts the crowd, and then I want to talk about it later because you're going to hear a lot of people not speaking in English, and then we'll tell you a little fact about that after this clip.
I'll spoil it. They're speaking German.
Not that fact, but okay. This is when Holly shows up to the porter's house and finds out there's a crowd gathering around, and the porter has been killed.
What is bloß?
Der Portier ist umgebracht worden.
Oh, I don't understand.
Porter, dead, kaputt.
The porter is ordered, kaputt. He's murdered.
Papa!
Was ist denn, Hans?
Papa, der war!
Was? Der Herr da?
Ja, Papa, ich hab doch gesehen!
Sagen Sie, haben Sie einen Streit gehabt mit dem Portier?
I don't understand.
Hier, wo gehst du hin? Ja, Papa, der was! Der was! Papa, der ist der Mörder!
What is it?
Porter's been murdered.
Wenn der ist, der mit dem Portier die Streiterei gehabt hat.
Wahrscheinlich ist der der Mörder.
I think you did it.
So what's really cool about that scene is the, and like all the rest of the movie, anyone who's not speaking in English, no one is subtitled.
No.
So anytime there is a kid, so that scene for a while, we don't quite know what's going on. The kid is just getting very excited, I'm sure. I mean, I think after a while, you're like, oh, wait, that kid was in the room earlier.
Yeah.
But you don't get it spelled out to you. The guys are kind of looking at each other. They're muttering under their breath. They're speaking a different language. Are they speaking, they're speaking German?
Yeah. That's what they speak in Austria.
Okay. So they're speaking German. And then, of course, we just get that very quick moment where Anna is like, oh, they think you killed the porter. And then it's just this building tension. And you really get put in, like, Joseph Cotton's shoes, like in Holly's shoes, because he doesn't know what the fuck anyone's saying. He doesn't speak German. And so as a result, we don't get to see what anyone's saying. Can I ask you a question? We got to talk about...
You may not. I am not an open book. I am a closed. I want you to think of me more of as a myth. But you know what? Just this one time, you may ask me a question.
Well, thanks. No, I want to talk about Anna a little bit. Played, of course, by Alida Valli. She is great.
Yeah.
I think she's wonderful in the movie.
She has a very minor role in this movie. She's not... Like this is the sort of role that you would generally assume to be the love interest, but it doesn't really work that way.
No, it kind of turns it on its head, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and I appreciate that.
By the way, a big point of contention between Carol Reed and Graham Greene, which we'll talk about in a bit once we get to that ending, but... she's great, and what I really liked about her is they have this whole subplot with her where she was with Harry Lime. Like, that was, you know, they were very close.
Yep.
She loved him anyway. Mm. Don't know so much about the other way around, although he did get her papers fixed for her so that she could basically forge her way into staying in the country.
Yeah, because it turns out she's actually from Czechoslovakia.
That was going to be my question, Jason. Yeah. You're the big history guy. So what was the issue with Russia and Czechoslovakia?
Well, that's the thing. Is like, so... At the end of the war, you had kind of had an option as a German citizen. You could run to the American lines or you could run to the Soviet lines. And most people were smart enough to understand that if you wanted to maybe not end up in a gulag, you would run to the American lines. Not everybody had that option, and it depended on where you were from, I believe. And in this case, she was from Czechoslovakia, which was an area that was under Russian control. So she was afraid of being sent back there. So she got papers forged to say that she was from Austria so she could stay there. But pretty quickly, when her papers are examined by Major Calloway, he pretty quickly determines that they are forged.
Yeah. Thanks to a, I think a Russian guy helps figure that out.
Yeah. Cause they work in an office where they're liaising with the, cause of course, if you'll remember folks at the end of World War II, the major powers.
I remember well.
You remember it well.
I was there.
You were there. The major powers at the end of World War II were England, France, the United States
and Turkey
and Russia.
Oh.
And they were the ones that controlled the different zones and various
Turkey?
Places. So they were all working together at that point. Even by 1949, which I think. Or was it 46 when the Berlin airlift happened? There had been some tension, but they were still kind of working together on administrating these areas.
Jason, rank it right now. I want you to rank the country Turkey on the all-time greatest countries list, 1 through 985. Do it.
Well, it used to be cool, but lately they've got a president who I'm happy to say on this podcast, and if it gets us banned in Turkey, Brendan, I don't care. Erdogan, go fuck yourself.
We do actually have listeners in Turkey.
Hey, guys. I'm sorry if the podcast doesn't come back, but I'm saying it right now. Erdogan, go fuck yourself.
But Jason, seriously, Turkey, rank it in the countries. I need a number.
I will say it's 75.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
1 to 965. You're saying 75.
Yeah, 75, right?
Because I don't know if you know this.
Top tier, like in the top part. But
I don't know if you know this,
guys.
There's
like 200 countries, Brendan.
There's 965 countries. Don't worry about it. But
you include the Martian countries, sure.
I include other planets, too.
Yeah, obviously.
And other solar systems.
We have connections to the future, so we know what's going to happen.
And, like, Star Wars characters I include. And
Luke Skywalker is a nation unto himself.
Yeah, Bejeweled rounds.
Ooh, I love Bejeweled. That's a great game.
Solitaire.
Space Cadet Pinball.
Game modes, Space Cadet Pinball. Now we're just saying things. Sean Connery.
File Explorer.
Fireworks. File Explorer.
Well, so you're talking about Windows games. So I just said, well, File Explorer, because it's in Windows.
You know, the thing about File Explorer is you can find everything there.
That's right. You check it out, folks. File Explorer. It's right on your desktop.
You don't even have to download a thing.
Nope. It's right there. It's
built right
in. If
you're not sure, do a search on your desktop. Type in File, space, Explorer.
Unless you're on a Mac, then look for Finder.
And I'll deliver a hot take right now. If you have a Mac, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, go fuck yourself, man. Come on. Says the guy with the iPhone. Fuck you.
So I wanted to listen to this scene with Anna because I think we got, again, we talk about her a little bit.
Sure.
Where she is basically used as currency because they say, okay, Anna, we're going to, Holly is very much in love with Anna, I think. It's very one-sided. I don't think he sees that she's in love with, I don't think she's in love with him at all.
Brendan, this is an example of that classic male failing of having a girl that is nice to you and then you assume that there's more there than there is.
Well, Jason, I don't know what you're talking about because I got so many girls in love with me. Yeah, it's not even funny.
I know you were a real Casanova.
Everybody I work with is totally in love with me.
Your office has some great orgies, by the way.
Thank you. It's nice of you to come by, even though you don't work there.
They're happy to have me. I'm the life of the party. I tell a lot of jokes.
So anyway, I was like, I better continue or else I'm going to forget what I was going to say. So she's kind of used as currency because Holly is told, look, we'll get her. We'll keep her safe. We'll get her out of here. I'm assuming back to Czechoslovakia.
Well, no, that's not where she would want to safely go back. They would probably want to send her somewhere else in the Western
somewhere
zone.
Somewhere else, yeah. We'll get her out of here somewhere safe.
Send her to West Germany or something.
If you help us get Harry Lyme, because at this point, Holly has told the cops, he's told Trevor Howard, you know, Harry's alive, and he's got this, like, underground tunnel that he goes into to hide, and he's out there.
The sewer.
Yeah, underground tunnel. That's where the same place the Ninja Turtles are from.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he's like, I'll help you. I'll help you get him if you guarantee her safety or whatever. And this is when he's there. He's kind of making sure that happens. But then she kind of isn't okay with that. And let's take a listen.
I watched you out of the train. No harm in that, is it?
How did you know I'd be here?
Well, I heard something about it at police headquarters.
Have you been seeing Major Calloway again?
Of course not. I don't live in his pocket.
Harry, what is it?
For heaven's sake, stop calling me Harry.
I'm sorry.
Zum Bezug.
What's in your mind? Why did you hide here?
Hide? Counterfeit, I have a drink. Here, be cold on that train.
I shall be all right.
You send me a wire as soon as you are.
What's going to happen? Where is Harry?
He's safe in the Russian zone.
How do you know?
Well, I saw him today.
How is he?
He can look after himself. Don't worry.
Did he say anything about me? Tell me.
What were the usual things?
There's something wrong. Did you tell Calloway about meeting Harry?
Of course I didn't tell Calloway.
Why should he help me like that? The Russians will only make trouble for him.
That's his headache.
His?
Oh, well.
Why are you lying?
We're getting you out of here, aren't we?
I'm not going.
You... Anna, don't you recognize a good turn when you see one?
You have seen Calloway. What are you two doing?
Well, they asked me to help take him. I'm helping.
Poor Harry.
Wouldn't even lift a finger to help you.
Oh, you've got your precious honesty and don't want anything else.
You still want him?
I don't want him anymore. I don't want to see him, hear him, but he's still a part of me, that's a fact. I couldn't do a thing to harm him.
Why do we always have to quarrel?
If you want to sell your services, I'm not willing to be the price.
I like the trades in this movie. Thomas, get out of here. It's not time for you. I just love the trades. The British love trades. They don't love you. Oh, they do, though. I'm a famous British trade. No, you're not. Get out of here, Thomas. Oh, jetpack.
I'm really glad you got rid of him quick.
I know, he's an asshole. But he does make a point, though. The British love their trains. We've seen trains in so many movies, and there's a train in this movie.
Well, trains are such a good dramatic device, I think.
Everyone loves a train, Brendan.
Right. But what I really like about that scene is that Anna is unlike a lot of female characters, I would assume, in the 40s. Mm. is portrayed rather strongly here.
Yeah,
because
no,
she's
she
like,
doesn't fuck around.
No, she's like, no. You don't get to make a deal and fuck over this guy that I'm very much in love with.
Yeah.
To set me free. Like, I'm not willing to be the price.
Yeah, he thinks he's being, like, chivalrous or doing some nice thing for her by selling out this guy that she does not want to be sold out, even though he probably should be sold out given what he's been doing.
And I wonder again, going back to my theory that he is not a very good writer, I wonder if he, thinking of all the stories that he writes, is like, this is how it's going to go.
Wow.
This is what I write about this. This is how it goes. I save the day. I got her out of the country, and I'm going to get the girl.
That's incredibly astute of you. I had not even considered that. But absolutely, this guy writes like trash fiction, as you say. Like, these kind of rote, trope-filled stories. And yeah, in his mind, the things he's doing will allow him to get the girl, which has been a trope that is, you know, rotted the minds of men for many years, the idea that we're somehow deserving of sexual relations because we did something nice for a lady.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I bought you a fucking cake, lady. Now suck my dick. Oh. But it doesn't work like that.
What movie is that from?
Ford Fairlane?
Probably.
Probably. I haven't seen it.
There's also a koala in that movie.
Oh.
But yeah, no, cool. I just kind of like, that's what I thought. I thought that was my theory.
Yeah. No, that's a good one. I appreciate that. I'm glad you saw that.
And that doesn't change. That's the thing. So in this movie, we get this amazing finale.
Oh, man.
In
the last
tunnels.
Scene in this movie. Or the last few scenes. So we get the tunnel chase, which is fantastic. Is one of the great noir like lighting experiments.
Lighting,
like,
the,
looks
editing,
so good.
The shots are beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically chasing Harry through the sewers as he tries to get away.
The underground tunnels.
In the underground tunnels. Where he's, like, this chase takes a little while, and it's like he's slowly being closed in on. He'll go one way, guys show up. He turns around, he goes a different way. He runs for a while. He seems like he's getting away, more guys show up. He's getting, like, boxed in, basically, as this thing continues on until finally, you know, he's kind of cornered by... by fucking Martins. So this doesn't make a lot of sense. That they just give this guy a gun and he's like, yeah, shoot him. Don't make that mistake. Shoot him, Martins. You know?
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think they really have to push him as a villain in this scene because Lime actually does kill the Sarge.
He
right?
does. The Sarge, the most lovable guy in the movie. He just loves the guy's books and he's lovely. Even though he punched him, he still comes across as like the coolest guy in the movie.
Because
he gets killed.
Well, I wonder if this is a studio note.
Yeah, well, I mean,
being like, you got to, before he dies, because. Yeah. You know, we're a little hesitant about how evil he is. Maybe make him real evil.
Well, because that's the thing. Is like, he's so likable, even though he's doing this horrible thing by you know, cutting this insulin and making money off
it. And I mean, that scene where Trevor Howard takes him to
insulin,
the children's...
The fucking penicillin.
When Trevor Howard takes him to the children's hospital, that scene is rough.
Yeah.
He's
basically
like, the
showing
teddy
him
bears
the results.
And
yeah.
the cribs, the broken cribs and
we
everything.
We don't even see the kids, but we see the reactions on their faces.
We see enough... To know that it's a great scene, but yeah, so that whole thing happens, and then crazily, Holly just fucking straight up shoots him and kills him, like he kills Harry Lime, and it's done in a way that's like, okay, so it was done in a way where I thought there was gonna be something else, like he goes off screen,
exactly. I
we
thought,
hear
oh,
the gunshot
because Harry already fucking faked his death once. Why not again? He's like, oh, it's my old buddy. I'm not actually gonna kill him.
I thought it was going to be like the Fast and the Furious or like Point Break where Patrick Swayze's going over the wall and Keanu Reeves just shoots up into the air like, wah!
But as you say, I think the kind of moral climate of the era demanded that he plug him at that
he
point.
He has to.
He has to. That you can't have the criminal getting away with it. Now, obviously, this was made in Britain. This is not where the Hays Code was in effect.
No, but they're still following similar things.
Exactly. You did have a film censor that was much more active.
You don't want to be
in the United States.
You don't want to be a video nasty.
No, absolutely.
I don't think that
headbutt
existed.
Someone and get banned from Britain.
I don't think that existed in 1949.
Well, the video didn't really.
Excuse me, did you lift a leg while you kissed her? That's a video nasty, that is.
Wop, wop.
But so he kills him, and then the way this like kind of subverts the whole like, oh, everything has to end as a happy ending, blah, 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 is that he does this big heroic thing where he's talking to Calloway, Trevor Howard, and he's talking, which, by the way, a hilarious running joke is that he keeps saying Callahan. He's like, I'm not Irish,
I'm not
it's Calloway.
Yeah.
And then what, at one point he says Callahan, and Sarge goes, that sounds anti-British. But he's having this conversation with him. It's this big triumphant thing. And then he's like, he sees Anna and he's like, you know what? Let me off here. I want to go talk to her.
And Calloway's right there like, we got to get you to the airport, man.
Yeah, we got you to the airport. And he's No, it's fine. And so he lets him out and he stands there and he waits for Anna. And the movie does this great thing, like Lawrence of Arabia-esque thing, where we wait for her to come from all the way down the street.
We just have a static shot, this beautifully framed kind of Wes Anderson-like center shot down the street. We have him standing off to the left side by a cart where he's placed his bag. And he's just standing there waiting for her. And she walks up the street. And it takes, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
She walks right at the middle of the street. And as she approaches him, she keeps her eyes forward and she keeps fucking walking.
She
walks right by him. And then he kind of watches her and then dejectedly lights a cigarette. And the movie ends.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, and I'm just like, I know this is not meant to be a happy ending, but I was kind of satisfied at that.
I was satisfied with that. Because
not that Holly is like a bad guy.
No, but she's a nice guy. She's her own person. She's not a slave to some dude who just thought he was doing right to save her when in fact it was not what she wanted.
And she loved Harry Lime regardless.
Yeah, and the fact that this dude's responsible for the murder of Harry Lime now, why would she want to associate with him?
Well, and it's funny because we go back up again. We're going to go back to Brighton Rock because at the end of that movie, that girl is very much in love with Pinky.
Yeah.
Not knowing what he said in that on that monogram,
on the record,
monograph or whatever.
Even at the end. And thankfully, the record skips for her benefit.
But I think that's the most tragic thing of the whole thing. But yeah, no, but like it just reminded me of that movie. So maybe that's the thing that Graham Greene is really into is that maybe that wasn't what the girl wanted.
Yeah, I think Graham Greene was kind of not transgressive is not the right word, but like a really like boundary pushing guy.
A bit progressive in terms of that. Yeah. Like in a normal film noir would either have, you know, she would turn out to be a straight up villain or she would just hook up with the main character.
Yeah, that'd be,
Or the main character would get pushed to do something he shouldn't have and he would get killed too.
Or she would get killed at some point and give him a reason to fucking, you know, keep doing what he's doing, an extra reason even.
Yeah.
Or Harry would kill her, and then that would give him even more like moral ability to like murder him and be cool with it.
Exactly, and that's not what happens.
No,
but Jason, I do want to play the greatest line in this movie, and it's a totally improvised line from Orson Welles. Wow. Let's hear it.
In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace. And what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
Such a great line. So cynical, but also great.
Yeah. And apparently it was improvised because they basically had to fill in a little bit of time there. Mm. And that's why he was like, the Swiss produced the cuckoo clock.
Now, I don't know if folks listening here have ever like watched any interviews with Orson Welles. If you haven't, I highly recommend you do. He is, again, he's as magnetic in interviews as he is on screen. Oh, yeah. He is such a fascinating character with such interesting stories. And whether they're true or not, he tells them so fantastically.
And just a guy who, of his time, such a modern performer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you could do this same performance now. And it would be like, people would be like, holy shit, that's incredible.
If Orson Welles was for some reason still alive and somehow not like a massive corpulent mess and was able to still act, he would still be able to act, I believe. Fucking, you know, like 110-year-old Orson Welles, he could do it.
Yeah, he would just have to be a lot of the similar characters to Man for All Seasons.
Yes. A lot of sitting down in his roles.
Yeah. But yeah, any other big... I know we didn't touch on everything. There's probably maybe still a few big things you want to talk about.
Well, we'll see. I have notes, but like often happens with movies I'm really enjoying, I didn't take as many notes as maybe if I didn't enjoy the movie. But we'll see what we got.
All right. Well, should we move on to Bits and Bobs then?
Let's do it, Brendan.
All right. We're going to move on to Bits and Bobs. But before that, we're going to take a break and hear from some of our sponsors. So stick around.
Yes, this is Orson Welles, and I invite you to listen to Age of Radio.
It's the final Bits and Bobs. It's the final Bits and Bobs.
Woo!
Because it's time for Bits and Bobs with Jason, and sometimes Brendan chimes in as well. And I do this so that Jason gets annoyed because he thinks I'm stealing it from someone else, but I'm not, because I've done this for years before I even heard an episode of the Flophouse.
Yeah, well, you knew who I was going to say you were stealing it from.
You should all listen to the Flophouse.
Look, I know it's not in my interest, but Elliot Kalin, if you're listening, and why wouldn't you be, please sue Brendan.
Please sue me, because then it means I could meet you
in court. So you can write your accuser.
Digital court.
I want to talk about Dune, Elliot.
Bits and Bobs with Jason and sometimes Brendan.
Did you notice, Brendan, that it's how quaint...
Airline food?
Yeah.
I know.
Did you notice how quaint the production logo was at the beginning, where it was called Big Ben Productions and they just showed a picture of Big Ben?
It was called London Productions, I believe.
Or London Productions, whatever. But it just showed a picture of Big Ben.
Yeah.
No animation, no nothing.
I also love how right after that, not only did we get the zither music, yeah. I'm sorry, not theremin.
Not a theremin, like you told me. It made me look like a fool to my friend.
You're welcome. But not only did we get the zither music, but we get a cool like opening credits where we actually see the zither being played.
Yeah.
Just a close-up of the zither.
Close-up
like,
of
the
many
moving.
Strings of a zither. Yeah. We get some narration at the beginning, which is kind of fast and casual and, again, very modern sounding.
Do you know who it was? Director Carol Reed.
Oh, weird.
So... originally, in the U.S. version, it's actually Joseph Cotten that does the narration.
That makes more sense, I suppose.
I think, though, this one was a little bit more cynical, and that's what they wanted. And I think in the U.S. one, they were like, make it Joseph Cotten and make it, like, not that. So it's not quite the same.
Dutch angles throughout this movie. Now, yes. I mentioned that Battlefield Earth kind of made Dutch angles a joke, but, like, back then, like, they really can be used to unsettle you and kind of like give the scene an extra edge to it. And I mean, this was a pioneer in that sort of thing.
I
can't think of any other movies we've seen that really extensively use Dutch angles.
No, I don't think so. Not
nothing
a lot. Maybe The Sporting Life.
Maybe there was some Dutch angles in there.
Yeah. Anytime he entered the house because you knew there was a beating coming.
Mm-hmm.
I like how the porter at one point says, and maybe this is like the overall theme of kind of misdirection that happens a lot in this movie, is when he mentions first that Harry Lyme was killed to Holly, he says in heaven, or he says he's in hell or heaven. And when he says hell, he points up, and when he says heaven, he points down.
He's a confused man.
Yeah, I just thought that was interesting.
Or maybe he's one of these guys that thinks like all the cool people are in hell. That's where the good parties are.
No, he hasn't heard about Republican Heaven.
No, he doesn't know. Unfortunately, it's not that good. Now, we have never talked about hell, but that's because it doesn't really come
into
play.
Why are there any British movies on the BFI Top 100 about hell? Come on!
Well, there's A Matter of Life and Death, but that didn't actually show hell.
That was heaven.
That was just heaven.
If you got a heaven, you got a hell.
Yeah. So he thinks of Calloway as a cop at the beginning, but he's military. Mm-hmm. The Military Occupation Authority. So
again, Trevor Howard,
great.
You
could sort of call him a gendarme.
And he's not Callahan.
No, he's Calloway, because he's not Irish. Ms. Schmidt wears a hat that reminds me of Carmen Sandiego.
Are you talking about Anna?
Yeah.
Okay. What? I thought we were getting so formal.
Well, they keep
there.
Calling her Ms. Schmidt. That's how I wrote her down here. She wears a Carmen Sandiego hat, and she got the trench coat that looks very Carmen Sandiego. So I'm wondering if Carmen Sandiego was inspired by her.
By this movie, it's good. There's a possibility.
Maybe Ms. Schmidt goes on to become Carmen Sandiego in her new life.
Where is she?
Nobody knows. That's why we have to find out.
Where in time is Carmen Sandiego?
Yeah, and then she started time traveling and things got weird.
Listen, yeah, it just got weird then.
Yeah.
There's a cop with a Hitler stash in this movie.
Yeah,
just for
but
like
that
a brief
was the
moment.
Style at the time.
But I just thought it was interesting because the year this came out, and he just kind of marches towards the camera, and we only see him briefly, and I'm like, oh, was that supposed to be like a, look at this fucking idiot.
I feel like we did see a guy with a toothbrush mustache that did speak, and he spoke in a very thick, like working class British accent.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, you would think by 1949 the toothbrush mustache would have fallen out of favor, but I guess it must have taken a little bit longer.
Thank God.
When we first see Lyme, I was wondering if it was actually like if you actually was seeing him or if it was like a hallucination.
Mm. I thought maybe that for most of the rest of the movie, we weren't going to be sure, and I don't think we were sure right away.
No. And then he follows him out into the thing, and he disappears in the square. And I looked at that square, and I thought that looks like a Call of Duty map.
That's because, Jason, yes, reveal it now. It is.
Oh, my God. Well, there is a Call of Duty map. I think it's called Piccadilly Square. I don't know that this was in Piccadilly Square, but because it's not, because it wasn't in England. It was in Vienna.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a conspiracy to kill Harry Lime so much as a conspiracy to fake his death.
By the way, he has one of the... By the way, when you see Harry Lime and you see Orson Welles, it's one of the best reveals ever.
It is. It is great. It's such a great, like lighting and everything, and then you see his face, and it's clearly Orson Welles.
And it's just illuminated by the fact that a woman... An angry woman opened her window, turned on her light, was like yelling because Holly was saw that there was a figure because he sees a cat around someone like walking her back and forth. And he says, oh, someone's there. So he's yelling. So an old woman opens her window, turns on her light and starts yelling at Holly. And then as soon as that light turns on, boom,
there's Harry his face hanging out in the doorwell.
And again, like you said, Jason, he is so magnetic. He is just a star.
Yeah. You just, from the moment you see his face, it's like, you can't help but be drawn.
It's like early Brando. Like, as soon as you see him, it's just like, holy shit.
He owns the screen when he's present, no matter what he is in. Even in Transformers movie, Brendan, playing Unicron.
Yeah, when you see his face as
Unicron.
You
see his face as that big fucking robot in space.
They should have fucking Angela Anaconda'd that shit and put his real-life face on the robot.
Guys, let's remaster the Transformers movie. We're starting a Kickstarter. We're going to put Orson Welles' face on Unicron.
No, let's put him on the wrong one.
Yes.
Hold on.
We'll put him on Bumblebee. let's see what else we got here.
But when he plays the radio, it's just clips from his War of the Worlds radio show.
When he goes, he meets up with Harry at a Ferris wheel, and that's a cool looking scene, like seeing out the window. And of course, when he's doing the whole bit about like, oh, if I told you you could eliminate any one of these dots and get 20,000 pounds, it's like a shot looking down, and you could see the little people like walking around.
It's incredibly cold.
Yeah, it's very cold.
Like Harry Lime is a great villain, and like, this scene, you're like, oh shit, he's a borderline sociopath at this point.
But I also understand the offer. Like if somebody came up to me and said, hey, if you could just get for every person that disappears on your order, you could get like $150,000. I mean, I'm not a psychopath, but I'll admit that I would think about it. I probably wouldn't do it, but I would definitely think about it.
I really like the line where Holly has convinced I really like the line where Holly has convinced Trevor Howard Calloway that Harry Lime is alive, and they dig up the grave and they find that other guy, and the line is, we should have dug deeper than a grave. I love that line. Yeah. It's such a good like double meaning.
It is a good one. Guys, stop doing things for women if you just think they're gonna fuck you.
Yeah, guys.
Get over it. Man, they don't have to.
One thing that really kind of startled me hearing in this movie, just because the time it was released, is there's a line about when they're preparing to deport Anna and send her away. Somebody makes a quick remark, and I don't remember who it is, says, just following orders.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say in 1949, that had some impact.
Well, especially considering we just had a whole Nuremberg trial where that was not a valid excuse for anything.
No.
Yeah. We had a little bit of comedy with the balloon guy wandering by, the old guy selling balloons.
Yeah, I love that. When they're planning this kind of stakeout.
Yeah, they're trying to catch Lime and trying to like be subtle, and this fucking balloon guy comes over and he wants to sell them balloons.
He's like, yes, fine, we'll buy a balloon.
Yeah, he won't take it over. And then we have a great scene of the Sarge grabbing a balloon and then just having this fucking balloon in his hand. It's very funny.
I have a question for you. Do you think Baron and Winkle are in a coded gay relationship?
Well, in the sense that the Baron reminded me of Peter Lorre, then maybe, I suppose, but...
The reason I ask is because there's a scene, so just before that meeting that he has with Orson Welles, with Harry Lime, in the Ferris wheel, he yells up at them, you know, bring him down, and I just noticed that, I think it was the Baron had, like, a house coat on, like a robe, but he didn't look like he was wearing anything underneath, and Winkle was just kind of there with him, and I was like, oh, okay.
Maybe he was just giving him an exam.
It's a real 39 steps Caldecott and Charters
just
moment.
Giving him a casual house prostate exam. It's what you do.
Yeah, you got to check your house prostate every once in a while.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's the house den mother or something. The house prostate is here. Mm. So everybody be on their best behavior.
You don't want to incur the wrath of the prostate. that's a fact.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much all I have. Jesus. Acting, Welles' face, like just watching Welles' face throughout this movie in various scenes, like he does so much just on his expression, and it doesn't feel like it's out there. It's like it's not stage acting. Like he's subtle, and you could tell what he's thinking.
Yeah, and that's basically all I have too for bits and bobs. I do have some behind the scenes kind of tidbits though.
Sure. So if you had behind the scenes stuff to talk about, Brendan, what might that be?
Well, I will say that before writing the screenplay, Graham Greene, kind of worked out the atmosphere, the mood of the story. And he did that by writing a novella first. So he wrote it as, essentially he wrote his own source material for the screenplay.
Which, you know, is not crazy. A lot of people do that.
Yeah, he never actually even intended to publish it, but then eventually he did. And he even took like a big tour of like the city and like the sewers and the less reputable nightclubs. Just to get an idea, kind of a sense of the story.
Well, Austria, like Vienna in Austria, even before, like, I mean, maybe not so much during the Nazi era, but before the Nazi era, was a famously cosmopolitan city. So, like, it was a place where you would go, and it was where everybody was, and there was interactions of culture and interplay. And actually, it's the city where Hitler went when he was a young man. And it was where he came up with this idea of like, oh, well, like all these racial groups tend to keep to each other. So that means they must, you know, mean something. And so I'm going to rank them. And white men were on top.
I'm going to rank them. You made a list.
Yeah.
The narrator in the novella is actually Major Calloway. Howard's character.
Yeah.
Other differences. So Holly and Harry Lime are both English in the book.
Interesting that they would change that for the movie.
I think it works better, though, that they're American.
I mean, it's cool because they're outsiders, too. And they're kind of even outsiders to the you know, Calloway and the Russian guy and, like, kind of the administration.
Because I think it works better, too, in that, like, Harry Lime would probably be the only other one that wouldn't understand German. And that he's the counterpart to Holly.
Maybe there was a consideration of, we wouldn't want to portray a British person as quite this shitty. Even though there were plenty of British people that were that shitty.
I mean, I still maintain this movie takes some shots at Americans for sure.
For sure. And they deserve it.
Goddamn right. Okay, so this is one of the craziest ones. So Crabbin, he's the guy that's like, come do the lecture for me.
Yeah.
Whatever. In the original draft of this screenplay, he was actually going to be replaced by two different characters played by Basil Radford and Naunton Wayne. That's right. Charters and Caldecott.
That would have been amazing. I mean, I don't know if it would have necessarily kept its place, but like, I like those guys. That would have been great if they'd have been in this.
And of course, they'd have been funny. And then of course, in the original ending, they pretty much hint that that much like the novella, that Anna and Holly are about to begin a new life together. And in the book, of course, you know, it does not happen. And Graham Greene was very unhappy with that. He wanted that ending. He said that was one of his very few major disputes with Carol Reed. He said, otherwise, the director and I got along great.
Like, he wanted them to hook up at the end.
He wanted it to be a happier ending. But then he said, to his credit, he did say later that he said one of the very few major disputes between Carol Reed and myself concerned the ending, and he has been proved triumphantly right.
Yeah. Okay.
So
good.
He is willing to accept that he was wrong about that.
In the long run, it worked better for the movie.
Yeah. Actually, David O. Selznick, who's one of the producers on this movie, very famous Hollywood producer, also stubbornly refused it. He was like, no, this does not end happy. That's so artificial. Basically was his thing.
Oh, so he was in favor of the actual ending.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good, good.
David O. Selznick's also, his big contribution to the movie was to have provided Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah.
Back in the day when they were probably under contract at the studio, needed to be lended out when, when they were to be used elsewhere.
So one of the rumors about this movie for many years is that Orson Welles secretly directed the movie.
Yeah.
And Orson Welles kind of added a little bit of fuel to the fire because he said, you know, it was Carol's picture, but he said he did contribute some of the film's best known dialogue. He also, at one point, he kind of turned away like, the producers, we can't talk about that, producers and such. Mm. So he kind of, but Peter Bogdanovich, who, as you know, is Orson Welles' friend because he only talks about it every other interview.
Yeah, and he's also a film historian and director himself.
Yeah. Basically said that Orson's involvement was minimal as far as like acting, and he improvised a few lines.
Yeah.
But I think the argument is this movie would be kind of unthinkable without Citizen Kane coming before it.
For sure. I wouldn't be surprised if Orson offered his opinion to Carol Reed. Like,
sure,
because he's a fellow director, so he would. I'm sure if Carol Reed was the sort that solicited opinions from his actors, he'd be happy to listen to it.
But maybe that didn't happen, Jason, because apparently Orson Welles, quote, generally annoyed everyone on the set. he didn't want to film. They were going to film in this in this sewer. They were going to film in this huge sewer, and he was like, no. So they had to move the entire production to the soundstage in the UK as a result of that.
I mean, he's a guy that had the weight to swing around to get that done, but at the same time, it's like, fucking do it, man. You're not better than the rest of us.
Carol Reed also probably, I mean, I think now we recognize how harmful this is, but Carol Reed had 4 different camera units shooting around Vienna for the duration of the production. And he basically he was so tired and do such long hours that he was popping Benzedrine to stay awake.
As you did back then.
Yeah.
Post-war era, everybody loved their uppers. Because so many of them were addicted from the war, but that's a different story.
We mentioned the cuckoo clock line earlier. Yeah. That's actually a line that Orson has been very upfront. He's like, I took that from something else, and I don't know what it is. And there's many theories about where it's from. But it definitely was lifted from something.
It's cool that he acknowledges, but nobody knows where.
He did also say, when the picture came out, the Swiss very nicely pointed out to me that they've never made any cuckoo clocks. He said, so, I mean, it wasn't a line that was rooted in history. It's just something I thought would have worked for the scene.
Yeah, and it did.
Yeah. The U.S. release of this movie. So again, I told you it starts off with a narration by Joseph Cotten instead.
Sure. Big star in America.
Yep. And there's just like various cuts here and there and dumb things. But they cut about 11 minutes of footage, though, which is crazy. I don't know where they cut that from.
That's crazy.
Because in the original UK release, you hear Carol Reed and he's kind of describing it from like the point of view of one of those racketeers, right? You know, some people work hard and some people are amateurs. And that's that great. I love that part of the beginning where he says some people are amateurs and we just see a body floating in the water. Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, that fucker didn't know what he was doing. Nope. In this one, it's very much just like Joseph Cotten standard voiceover. I'm guessing they were like, Americans don't want to hear a criminal at the beginning.
No, why?
Yeah. But that's all I have. But I do have that this movie goes to the Oscars.
Yay.
It loses to English Patient. No, it
Scarface.
It is nominated for two categories. Not nominated for two films.
No,
nominated for two categories. Nominated for Best Editing.
Okay, yeah.
Which is won that year by King Solomon's Mines.
Not seen that, have you?
No, but I've heard of it a few times.
Yeah,
it's also nominated for Best Director for Carol Reed or Orson Welles. But the winner that year is Joseph L. Mankiewicz for All About Eve. Which is a great fucking movie.
Another movie I've heard of, but never seen.
But it wins one award. What do you think?
Best Supporting Actor for Orson Welles?
Nope. It wins Best Cinematography, Black and White.
Oh, well, absolutely. For sure. Yeah. It deserves that.
It also, just a note, I thought it was interesting. It also won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
Okay.
And at the BAFTAs, it's nominated for Best Overall Film, but it loses to Bicycle Thieves, which is actually a great Italian.
Oh.
Kind of, I guess, neorealist is what it falls under, okay. But it's really good.
I always thought that was a French movie. Weird.
No, it's Italian. Hmm. And it wins Best British Film.
Okay, good.
Which sense. Later, I'm going to uncork the conspiracy here.
Oh, no.
Because this movie says Alexander Korda presents. The Best British Film Award would later be called the Alexander Korda Film Award. Mm. Hello. Hello.
I smell something funny.
Hello.
Hello.
This was the most popular movie in the UK box office in 1949. But in Austria, critics were underwhelmed. I wonder if it's just because they could understand it.
Yeah.
We know what's going on.
Maybe they didn't appreciate the acting of all the German extras. Maybe they were very stiff.
Yeah. Somebody actually noted that in Britain, it's a thriller about friendship and betrayal. In Vienna, it's seen as a tragedy about Austria's troubled relationship with its past.
Sure. Yeah.
Some critics at the time criticized the unusual camera angles.
Oh, those poor babies couldn't handle it. Those poor little titty babies.
Somebody from the Observer said, not the Wrestling Observer, this wasn't Dave Meltzer. He said, Reed's habit of printing his scenes askew with floors sloping at a diagonal and close-ups deliriously tilted were most distracting. That just shows how things change.
What a fucking lame guy. Can't understand it.
Director William Wyler, so the director of like Ben-Hur and a bunch of epics, is also a close friend of Carol Reed.
Yeah.
And he sent him a note that said, Carol, next time you make a picture, just put it on top of the camera, will you? So it got overwhelmingly positive reviews, though, for the most part, in the UK and America. Of course, Bosley Crowther of the New York Times said it brilliantly packaged the whole bag of his cinematic tricks, his whole range of inventive genius for making the camera expound. Carol Reed's eminent gifts for compressing a wealth of suggestion in single shots, for building up agonized tension and popping surprises are fully exercised. His devilishly mischievous humor also runs lightly through the film, touching the darker depressions with little glints of the gay or macabre. Roger Ebert gave it 4 out of 4. Is on his great movies list. Film has a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, much like Citizen Kane, because they dug up that super old, clearly review from a William Randolph Hearst newspaper.
Yeah.
The budget for this movie was $9 million.
It's a good amount of money in 1949.
So there you go. Jason, I can't believe I'm saying this, but this is it, man.
Man, it's the last movie.
Number one. So what do you think?
Just get it out of the way. This movie is not my number one.
Oh, shit.
But this is a great movie. I really enjoyed this movie. This is a fantastic piece of British film noir, featuring, as I said, Americans and filmed in Vienna. But like, and now, George Calloway, of course, is British and is great.
Now, could you Trevor Howard?
Trevor Howard, a.k.a. Calloway, who I assume his first name is George. I don't know.
Yeah, sure. Everyone's first name is George.
Yeah. I'm thinking of that other guy, the other George.
From A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, that guy.
Now, could you see, like, I know you said this personally for you, it's not going to be in your top one, but could you see why this is kind of the top one?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is a fantastically made movie. Like, it is, as you said, the script is super tight. There's a lot of stuff that's set up, and then it pays off at in the end of the movie. It looks great. The acting is fantastic. Like, I absolutely understand why this is number one. It's not my number one, but I understand why it's number one.
Yeah. I don't know if it's my number one, too, but I will say right now, I think it's probably in my top 10.
Yeah.
I think this movie. Surprised. Yeah, this movie is incredibly well made. I mean, this is a pioneer of filmmaking. This is a classic. You can't watch this movie and come away not thinking, I just watched an amazing fucking movie.
You can't come away from this movie thinking that someday Roger Christensen will make Battlefield Earth.
And he'll do this even better.
He'll improve upon it.
But yeah, no, it's fucking great. Shit.
Yeah, I mean, what else can you say? The performances are great. It's a fast-paced story. It's an hour 45, I think, when all said and done. Like, it's a good watch.
Jason, that's it.
That's it.
We're done.
We watched 100 movies. In less than 3 years, we watched 100 movies. I'm sure you watched 1,000 yourself.
But. I've almost watched 300 for the first time this year.
Oh, wow. I'm impressed.
So there you go.
Good job.
I have 2 podcasts, so it's fine.
That's true.
But yeah, no, that's the 100 movies. I don't want to ruminate on this too much because we will obviously come back to this. We will wrap this all up. But next week, we are going to do just like we normally do.
We're going to do a special on the last 20 we watched.
Yep, there's going to rank them. We're going to give out some awards. We're going to have a good time and a long time and a great time.
So have a good time. The sun can't shine every day.
Not every day. Unless you're in, I don't know.
Well, Los Angeles, the sun shines a lot.
Okay.
But then when it rains, it's a big deal. Everybody goes fucking crazy. That's
They're
what
like,
I
ah,
assume.
Rain!
I listen to a lot of podcasts from LA, and when it rains, I think everybody goes into it. Do you ever see that episode of Star Trek where they worship the computer, and then they have the red hour? They worship Landru, and then they have that red hour where they all go crazy. Basically, it's the inspiration for The Purge. It's like that when it rains.
I was hoping you were asking the listeners, because I was like, no, I have not seen
that.
Oh,
we should watch that sometime. It's great.
Well, there you go. So, yeah, next week we'll rank the last 20 movies. We've got 2 audience Brit picks after that. Two of the ones, we looked through the list of ones that you guys suggested, and we picked, Jason and I each picked one that we thought was worth a watch.
Because there's a lot of British movies that are worth watching that aren't on this list.
And we'll get to that soon enough. And then we'll, after we rank the last 20 next week, after we do our 2 Brit picks, the final episode of the year, the final full episode of the year, is going to be our wrap-up on the BFI Top 100.
That's right. We will go through our bottom 10 and top 10s and maybe talk about a few things in between.
Yeah, and we'll put the lists out. Listen, I'm just going to tell you right now. Jason and I are not going to sit here and read off all 100 of our, but we'll each prepare.
We will post them.
We'll each prepare a nicely labeled list a very organized top 100, and then side by side, and you decide who's right and why it's Brendan. Ha ha!
This guy.
So there you go. We'll be back next week. We'll rank them. This is the beginning of the end, folks. So,
pretty soon we will commit suicide, as we said.
As we said, right at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Just in time for Christmas.
And then we will come back to life and begin the Canadian movies.
Right. We'll come back to life. Yeah. We'll be like a fox and a hound.
What?
We'll be reincarnated.
I haven't seen that movie. Did they come back to life?
Well, you don't know. Oh, sorry. So Fox and the Hound actually starts with a couple of Buddhists.
Oh.
And I don't think that's their tradition. I'm horrible. It just starts with a couple of guys, and they're like, they believe in reincarnation.
Okay.
And they both kill each other because they want to come back as something cool. And they each come back as a fox and a hound, but they don't remember who they were.
Okay.
But then the fox and the hound just happens.
And then they have sex, right?
Off screen.
But you can hear it.
You can smell it.
Oh.
It's one of those scratch cards. Smell-o-vision.
Yes, baby.
Yeah,
yes.
They give you those scratch cards when you put the DVD in.
Smells like the bus.
And Teen Spirit. So there you go. I am prolonging this because I just can't believe this is the
end of the
list.
It's amazing. And guys, thank you so much for listening and being with us through this whole thing. I mean, we're not quite done yet, but like, this is a milestone. This is crazy. I can't believe that in my life I will be able to tell to people if they ask. Why would they ask? But if they ask, I'll be able to say, yes, I did watch the entire BFI Top 100.
Well, listen, if someone asks if you're a film buff, you're a film buff now.
Well, I mean,
you've
that's
done
the
it.
Thing. I may not have seen Jaws, but I've seen 100 British movies.
I'm going to make a guarantee right now on this podcast. There will be an episode where Jason will watch Jaws.
And there will be an episode where Brendan is forced to watch Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
There you go. Guarantees from both of us.
And maybe Space Seed as well, just to give them context.
Sure. but there you go. So you can find us all over the place. You can search for us on Facebook. You can just search for Four Screen.
On the country.
You can find us on Twitter at FSACpod, as in Four Screen and Country Podcast. You can find Jason on Twitter.
At Jason D. McLeod. That is M-A-C-L-E-O-D. Stop on by, ladies and gentlemen, and let's get weird.
Give him 100 reasons, baby.
13 reasons why.
That's a dark turn that took. But yeah, and you can find us of course, on all the podcast apps. Whatever you're listening to on right now totally works. But
Let us know that you're listening. We'd love to hear from people. We're a small podcast. We have a small audience, and it absolutely tickles us when we know that you guys are listening.
No, for sure. Let us know. Post on our Facebook. Tweet us.
I mean, we love Brad Apps. We love Colorization Guy.
Yeah, well, there was a gentleman who posted on our Facebook the other day, which is really nice. He said we were his entertainment on his way to work.
And for Colorization Guy, whose name I don't remember.
It's like Color Horizon?
Color Horizon, yeah. You should check him out because he has an interview with us. We did an interview. We actually did an interview with somebody. Somebody cared enough to ask us questions, Brendan.
They did. And we were very honest.
We were very honest. We had hot takes. We were on the verge of getting canceled, but we said what we believed.
That's right. Yeah. So, let us know you're listening. We love to hear from you. I will tell you right now, guys and girls and people of all gender denominations.
All gender identities.
If I could choose between having, you know, a million listeners and having just like a solid bunch of people who just respond and comment and let us know what's going on, I would rather have that.
When we hear from Sharon Horwat or Aylin Allen or Adam Pellman or Andrew Littlefield, I said it right.
Or Sergeant Charger Williams Holt.
Sergeant Charger Williams Holt is one of our
and many others.
People. Many others. Just because we didn't name you doesn't mean we don't love you. And to that gentleman who gave us our name here on this last episode, we have to thank you. Whose name I never remember, but without you, we wouldn't have our wonderful name that nobody else has.
Daniel Barula.
Thank you, Daniel Barula. I may have said it before, but I'm pretty sure you're a famous singer.
Yes. I mean, I think you're close. You also could be Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out. It could be a pseudonym.
Could be Daniel Kaluuya, and he's just like the representative of the Kaluuya brand.
Why hasn't Daniel Kaluuya signed that endorsement deal yet?
He should. He really should. Also, if anybody out there is a representative for Kaluuya, send us some, and we'll drink it on the podcast.
For your benefit.
Or any liquor. Folks, if you are a representative of a company that sells liquor, let us know, and we will be happy to sample it.
Yeah.
Because we're influencers. There's like 50 people that would love to hear our opinions on the liquor that you send us.
I love how much you undersell us. So yeah, we're just pushing the issue now. We're done. So we will see you all next week.
I tell you what, folks, if you send us free liquor, we will send it to Sharon Horwat. And she will promote it in a way that you can't even imagine.
Jason, that's a promise that I don't know if we're going to have an easy time keeping. Well, I don't know if I could ship alcohol.
If we get the liquor first, then we'll figure it out. If Sharon lives in Canada, shouldn't be a problem. If she lives elsewhere, it might be a problem. But we'll just throw it in the ocean or something.
I don't think she's in Canada.
Oh. Well, you know what? We're not all perfect.
I'm sorry. Did you say we're going to throw it in the ocean?
Yeah, we'll throw it in the ocean, and she'll just pick it up on the coast.
It's going to be like that movie Message in a Bottle.
She'll just have to go to Newport News, Virginia, and pick it up.
Right. She'll be the Harry Connick Jr. to our Sandra Bullock.
That's right. Oh, Harry Connick Jr., where are you now?
Probably angry because he wants the show to wrap up.
What if they remade The Third Man with Harry Connick Jr.?
All right, that's it, Jason. We are going to see you next week. And all I got to say for one of the final times, I think we're going to keep saying it.
Well, I mean, we're going to keep saying it.
We're going to keep saying it.
Folks, before we leave, I need you to know. Like, I really would like to keep a Commonwealth theme on this podcast. We may watch movies that are not British, but we want to try to keep that in mind because, you know, we're from Canada. Canada traces its roots back to the British
We're still
Empire.
Part of it.
We're still sort of part. We're part of the Commonwealth, you know. And
we're actually undercover.
Maybe we should watch some Irish movies. We could watch some Australian movies. We could watch some New Zealand movies. We could watch some South African movies.
Ooh,
American. We could watch North American movies.
There you go.
I mean, America used to be part of the British Empire.
Yeah. Well, there's some stuff coming. You guys will like it.
Yeah, you'll like it. And if you don't, you know what? Fuck you.
Or just don't listen.
There's so many podcasts out there. Just if you don't like what we're doing, guys, go listen to fucking Joe Rogan
or
Adam Carolla or anybody else who was on the Man
Show. You know,
show.
If you're a big fan of Adam Carolla, I don't know if I want you around.
By the way, folks, just a quick aside.
Oh, my God.
Man Show, if you watch the Man Show, does not hold up.
Oh, weird.
I know, it's weird. But one of them
turned out okay.
Yeah, no. And the other, not so much.
Not so much.
But he can build benches, Brendan.
God save the queen.
God save the screen.
And for Screen and Country, I'm Brendan.
And I'm Jason. You know who else is my favorite comedian who
God
can build things?
God damn it.
This is the end. My only friend. The end of our elaborate plans. The end of everything that stands. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be so limitless and free? Of some stranger's hand. It all-